Hello, podcast listeners. Welcome to another episode of the Rational Face Podcast, the best podcast on the Blobbernacle, where we keep Mormonism weird. I am Brian Dillman.
And I am Brian Kissel.
So, Brian, I'm sure you've heard the news about John DeLynn. So, why don't you share your thoughts on this moment that we've kind of, in a lot of ways, we've seen it coming from last summer. You know, as you heard about it, what are your thoughts?
Wow, yeah, it's been a crazy week. So many differing emotions, so many different feelings. I personally have been following John for about like 7 years. I really closely. I've listened to everything, almost everything that he's created, all the podcast episodes, and there's a lot of stuff. Actually, really influential on my own personal spiritual journey. And I don't know, it's been really interesting because throughout that whole period of time, I mean, these kind of things have been occurring. Like, I remember when he first was called in to meet with his stake president the very first time. And at that time, it affected me much more. I felt as if it was like the court, these kind of courts and this kind of checking into John DeLynn, it was checking in on me, you know, and I felt, and it was interesting because when as time went by, and then John DeLynn, this was a little while after, but then John DeLynn was able to end up baptizing his kid, it felt like, look, there is a place for me in this church because I'm not alone. You know, there are other people who are like me, and it was never like there are certainly things that I am critical of John as along with everybody that I've ever heard. But the fact that he played such an influential role in my own personal spiritual journey, it really does kind of make me sad to see this happen to him.
Yeah, and in our that's kind of how I've felt as well. It's you know, it's just sad. I don't think there's any other way to really say it. And yeah. We had a discussion yesterday with Dan Weatherspoon, Joanna Brooks, Jennifer Finlayson-Fife, and Natasha Parker, and we talked about how do you deal with that sadness? How do you deal with the emotions that come? And I think they have given us really good perspective and given us ways to think about this situation and ways to process and ways to move forward. And so that's the podcast today, and I think we ought to get right to it. Welcome, podcast listeners. Today we have a special tri-podcast release with Mormon Matters, Rational Faith, and Mormon Mental Health. We're responding and talking about the news today that John DeLynn has been excommunicated, and we're all actually very sad about that. And we have a panel to talk about how we can respond as a faith community, or how, more appropriately, I think, is personally, how do we deal with these emotions as this sad event has happened. And so we have Joanna Brooks, Dan Weatherspoon, Jennifer Finlayson-Fife, and Natasha Helfer-Parker. And real quick, just to make sure all the listeners know who is who, let's just go through introductions. And I'm the host of Rational Faith Podcast, so I'm going to follow Dan Weatherspoon's lead. And Jennifer has been on Rational Faith more than anyone else. And so, Jennifer, why don't you give us a brief introduction to who you are and what you've been involved with?
Sure. I'm Jennifer Finlayson-Fife, and I live in Chicago, Illinois, and I am a psychotherapist, and I work primarily with LDS couples and individuals on relationship and sexuality issues. And I just talk a lot in the LDS community about sexuality and relationships within an LDS context.
Thank you. Natasha, why don't you go next and talk about who you are and what you've been involved with online.
Okay, I'm Natasha Helfer-Parker, and I live in Wichita, Kansas, and I also am a therapist trained in marriage and family therapy and also sex therapy, and I, like Jennifer, work mainly with LDS family systems and couples and individuals around all types of issues, whether it's relational or faith transitions or just your normal kind of run-of-the-mill mental health disorders. I started with writing the blog The Mormon Therapist kind of as a asking questions and getting answers type of format, and that has gotten a lot of readership. And then from that, I've also done the Mormon Health Podcast and currently trying to found the Mormon Mental Health Association, which we're really excited about, and Jennifer's actually involved with that as well.
Great. Thank you. Dan, who are you? Tell us about Dan Weatherspoon.
Well, I think most people recognize this crazy voice from Mormon Matters, which is the podcast I've hosted for almost 4 years now. I actually began a little bit before that hosting some discussions for Mormon Stories. John had asked me to interview a few folks, and I did 5 or 6 of those before taking over Mormon Matters. One thing that Natasha didn't mention about her and I that we both share is that we're both board members of the Open Stories Foundation, which is the umbrella organization that kind of oversees Mormon Stories, Mormon Matters, and so we're anxious for what's going to happen going forward here with plans to build a constructive, you know, continued discussions here. So
that's
probably enough for me. Thanks.
Great. And Joanna is one of the very famous Mormons that's been brought into the media over the wonderful Mormon moment experience. Joanna, remind anyone else who doesn't know who you are, what you've been up to and who you are.
Hi, everyone. This is Joanna Brooks. I'm really pleased and honored to be on this podcast with people I love tremendously and admire. It's good to be together in a moment like this. I have a lot of love for Dan and Jennifer and Natasha for the work they've done. So I live in San Diego. I'm a dean at San Diego State University. I am the author of the Book of Mormon Girl, which was published a few years ago during the Mormon moment. And I'm editor of a forthcoming book called Mormon Feminism, 40 Years of Collected Essays, which will be, I hope, later this year. Did that with Hannah Wheelwright and Rachel Hunt Steenblick. It's a collection of 40 years of Mormon feminist writing never before put together. So we're very pleased that will be coming out from Oxford University Press this year. I'm a permablogger at Feminist Mormon Housewives, and I did serve with Dan and Natasha on the board of the Open Stories Foundation some years ago.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So John's work is very dear to my heart, as is John and the DeLynn family.
Thank you, Joanna. That's some exciting stuff coming up.
Yeah.
So I'll give kind of an overview of what I think for me what all this means. Natasha mentioned her Mormon Therapist blog, and I think that was the first blog that was in the bloggernacle or in the blogosphere that I became aware of, and I was reading a lot of things on there, and I found it very helpful. And then I found Mormon Stories and Mormon Matters, and I the interview with Natasha and Jennifer talking about your dissertation, Jennifer, was also very helpful and enlightening. And for me, the Mormon Stories and Mormon Matters, I think I've listened to all the episodes. They've been so important to building a constructive faith or a constructive relationship with the church after a faith transition. And, you know, Joanna's been on both of those venues, and her book provided this perspective that I was completely unaware of. And all of this is connected because of our very ambitious friend, John DeLynn, and he just started podcasting kind of out of nowhere and built this foundation and built this little world that we inhabit. And so this news of him being excommunicated from the church is pretty hard to take. And I don't think my experience and my story is all that unique. I think a lot of people they felt that their faith has been saved, or that they've found a path and their mental health has been improved through some of these venues that have all stemmed from Mormon Stories or the Open Stories Foundation. And so I personally have a lot of concern for friends and relatives that are hurting, and myself that are hurting, watching John be removed officially from the faith community. And I think he'll continue to do his podcast, and he'll have his presence. That won't change, but it hurts to see the faith that you love reject in an official way a person that you love, or a person that has provided so much that has been beneficial for you. And so as we're all feeling these sort of emotions that come up, the feelings like we are being excommunicated we have all sorts of feelings that come up as John and previous and last summer as Kate Kelly have been disciplined. And so the question is, how do we deal with this? And according to the Kubler-Ross model on loss, on grieving, it's expected that we're going to have these emotions, that we're going to have anger, that we're going to feel depression, that we're going to have some form of denial, and not necessarily in a specific order, but these things are going to happen. And sometimes the advice is to go vent, to let steam off. And the metaphor there is that human beings are like teapots, and if we let off a little bit of steam, then the pressure is relieved. But the problem is humans are not teapots, and that we have feedback loops, and our brains rewire, and constantly venting can cause more problems. And there's other research in the field of psychology that shows that venting can produce more aggression, and so it might not be the best thing to do. And so we don't really have direction besides the common sense direction of go punch a pillow or go vent online or talk with a friend or something. So I want to first talk to our therapists, Natasha and Jennifer. What are some productive ways to experience and process these frustrations and different emotions that are likely going to be coming our way if they're not already here?
Yeah, I mean, I guess even before we start talking completely about it, I do want to just say that, you know, it is a difficult day, I think, for all of us. And I feel it very personally. I mean, I have worked with John for many years now and love him and his family and his wife. And it's painful. And I think pain then becomes a lot of different things. And I think, you know, as I read through some of the posts and some of the reactions of all of our different, you know, ward and congregation members, you see a variety of responses, right? There's people who are also hurting and have pain, and there's also people who see this as the correct step and feel even maybe vindicated for their positions, or just see this as a necessary part of moving ahead in our church. So there's a wide range. And so I'm thinking about how to answer your question. I'm thinking about the many family systems that, you know, we may be addressing, because within a family system, there may be people who feel very differently about what happened today. And so that becomes an issue in of itself. So I'll start, I guess, with, you kind of mentioned anger and venting off steam. And I think that it's important to treat anger as a legitimate feeling and to let it inform you. I think oftentimes anger gets a bad rap as a feeling in of itself, often because then behavior follows. It isn't always very, it doesn't, I guess, come out with the most mature parts of ourselves when we allow for that. But anger in of itself is a legitimate feeling. And I always kind of love the scene of Jesus Christ in the temple throwing everything around, not so much because he's throwing everything around, but because here's this, person that we see as divine expressing anger, and therefore that anger in of itself not need be seen as sinful. But like you said, at the same time, it can escalate. And I think if we stay in angry spaces, that can be unhealthy for us. So I like to talk about anger being legitimate and wondering then, well, what is this anger trying to clue me into, and using it as a clue. We usually talk about anger in the psychology field as a secondary emotion, meaning that something is driving the anger. So what is that something? Is it pain? Is it fear? Is it uncertainty? Is it insecurity? And then those are the more primary emotions. And so that's why I think anger is important to understand, and not just to sweep it under the rug either, which is the other extreme of not addressing it and not letting it come to play, which then is repressed and then can cause other issues as well. And in fact, depression is often seen as repressed anger of some issue or another. So I don't know if that's a good first kind of start, but I think that, you know, the next thing I would talk about is differentiation, and I think Jennifer does a much better job at that.
I think that's a great start to legitimize anger, and really all of our emotions. Our emotions aren't fake. We don't make this stuff up. So I think it's important to legitimize that and then maybe find a way to think about what it means, like you were saying. Is it because you feel uncertain about your standing? Is it because you feel betrayed? You know, why is it that you're feeling angry, and not to just ignore it or sweep it under the rug?
Yeah, and right. What I want to just kind of briefly mention as well, especially if you're in a family system where you don't necessarily agree with either your spouse or your children or your friends about this issue, to understand that staying in a space of anger with one another will be detrimental, obviously, to the relationship. So again, like finding the space for it, and maybe even expressing that, yes, I'm angry with you for not seeing things the way I do. But, you know, I'm sure we'll start talking about, you know, how we very quickly can get polarized. And there's this great book out too called, I think it's called The Reptile Brain, or Reptiles in Love, something with the reptile. Anyway, the whole idea is that when we get escalated and angry, that clues us into our fight-flight response. And therefore, your blood and your whole adrenaline system and everything is going to your limbs, not your brain. And we actually become stupider when we're upset. Which, nice. I mean, they actually measure this, like your IQ goes down. So we're not in our best, like, logical space when we're angry. So sometimes just even, you know, taking a time out, learning how to breathe, you know, using some healthy coping mechanisms to get you through that initial angry space, so that then you can have a sit down conversation with somebody that you find yourself polarized with, might be something to look into as well.
Yeah. So I'm just trying to think which thoughts I have to add, because I agree with so much of what's just been said already. And, you know, that anger can instruct us. And I think also just the grief, you know, to be able to acknowledge that for so many of us, I think the grief, again, just like anger, can be informed by many different meanings. But there's, you know, for many of us, the church matters deeply. And it can feel like it's a personal rejection. If you identified with John DeLynn, if you identified with what he offered and provided you, mm-hmm. and seeing the church as making an official rejection, I think both the anger and the sadness can be a feeling that you are also being told that you're not the right kind of Mormon. You don't really belong to the group. And this can also be, as Natasha was saying, very personal, because it can be expressed right in the context of families, where, you know, one of the reasons why the church has so much sway over people or power over people is because it gets expressed in family systems. And that is to say that you can disagree with your parent or your sibling on something and feel literal division from them because you can't see eye to eye. And when there's an official sort of rejection of a perspective, I think it can feel personal, and I think those things are really hard. And I think, you know, I don't feel particularly articulate tonight, so I'm going to do my very best to kind of name all the elements, but I think that there's this tension between two realities. One is that, you know, the church, how to say it, the church leadership's behaviors and choices and decisions have a real effect on us. To take an official position to excise John Dolan from the church has a real effect on our sense of where we belong in this faith community, who we are. And that's part of the anger and the grief and the frustration and the feelings of powerlessness I think that people can feel. And at the same time, I think the way to manage the emotions is to both tolerate that those are legitimate and important, at the same time that you don't get stuck in the powerlessness or the victimhood stance of feeling that other people's decisions have so much sway or control over your sense of self and who you are. And so, you know, the productive element, you know, one of the reasons why I think, you know, just venting anger is so counterproductive is like Brian was saying, not only is it not about just venting and letting it off, you're actually creating something. You're actually creating a deeper sense of being of someone else's victim, which is to create a deeper sense of dependency on someone that you don't like or trust. And so the sometimes counterintuitive thing, and then sometimes what people do is they'll go into a more rebellious stance, just very invested in being hateful or hostile towards what has harmed them or caused them pain. But I think the harder move, but the productive one, is to define who we're going to be in this moment. What am I going to stand for? I understand. I think this is,
yep.
What am I going to be about? Because I'm still a Mormon. I'm a part of this community. What kind of person am I going to be in response to this? Because I get to craft that, even though I don't get to control the context in which I'm crafting that. And that's a way to not feel so powerless. That's a way to fuel our unhappiness with choices or decisions outside of our control, to be literally creative, to literally create the realities that we believe are right or better or important. And so, I mean, I really think, and I think at the core, that is the process of differentiation, which is to define within a context of being in connection, in relationship with others, who am I going to be within this larger context? That I'm not going to let it define me and me be in reaction to it, in simple reactive reaction to it. I guess that's redundant. But rather a kind of in a response to that context, but one that's deliberate and as wise as I can muster. And I think the wisdom comes in the ability to kind of calm our reptile reactive self down enough to take a look at the larger picture and to kind of understand, to gain some wisdom in what's happening in the larger context so that we don't feel quite so powerless or reactive to it.
I think that is wonderful advice. Thank you both, Natasha and Jennifer, for giving us a way to think about this rather than simply reacting, as you were just saying.
Well, the only thing I would add to what Jennifer said is everything we just said, don't expect to do that tonight.
Yeah, that's right.
Give yourself a week or two or three.
Yeah, if we don't want to put too high of a bar.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that would be
more of a problem.
Absolutely. It would be weird and unhealthy to have it all wrapped up. You know,
I'm fine. I've thought about it right, so I'm fine.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, well, as I understand it, Joanna, you have in different podcasts and in different venues, you've always given really good perspective. What can you share with us regarding how to keep our composure or how to keep things from escalating within ourselves and within our community?
Well, thanks, Brent. I hope so. You know, I've pulled back a bit from social media since Kate's excommunication in June, and I've struggled with that, why I felt like I had to do that. And I realized that part of it is I'm a scholar by training, and I'm a historian, and my training is in the histories of the modern world, the early modern world. So I take the long view on things, and my mind is trained to take the long view. And I've thought a great deal about, over the last decade, I've thought a great deal about our moment in Mormon history. And there's no question that John's excommunication and that these years we've been living through are a significant moment in the history of our people. And it's really not personal to John. I think John is a person of unique and extraordinary, you know, talents and demeanor and personality with a great capacity for empathy. But this is really about our movement, about the Mormon people, and how we are passing through history and processing this beautiful tradition that is ours alone. And it's really a coming of age moment for us. Every world faith has gone through this kind of moment when there's a transition in at least some sector of the movement from literal to post-literal. And, you know, our moment, Mormonism, you know, we're such a young faith. We're living everything on an accelerated pace. But there's no question that this moment is breaking as it does, or has broken as it has, because of technology, you know, because of podcasts, the availability of information, you know, candid information about the Mormon past, about Mormon scripture that John has processed, that so many of us have been reading about, accessing and processing through the internet. But I think also, you know, that this moment, you know, and John's, the way John interpreted it, you know, he broke with some unwritten rules for how Mormonism has conducted itself for the past 100 years that I've been thinking a lot about. And I just speak a little bit about that, and how if understanding the rules and sort of cycle that Mormonism has been caught up in can maybe help us step out of the cycle and recognize it and do it differently. And I think one thing that was really significant about John, about all of us who've been doing this moment in Mormon history, is that we've been, and John especially, kind of modeled this candor and this humanness. I mean, he was going to take us through every step of his faith struggle in detail, on air, being willing to talk publicly about the flaws in our faith. And that broke some very important rules. The history of our faith coming out of a context where we were ridiculed from the beginning for what was perceived to be fabrication, where Mormons were shamed and antagonized and criticized by the secular and non-LDS world, you know, contributed to, and I have this all mapped out as sort of a cycle, and there's a graphic I've sent the podcast host that, you know, maybe it'll be useful to post. But imagine that whole context of shaming and caricature and criticism and antagonism out of which Mormonism was born, creating this whole set of behaviors in the core LDS or the base, you know, about withdrawing and being militant and retrenching, and even sometimes doing what I have called in some scholarly work on Mormonism, undergrounding, a term I take from the years when polygamy went on the underground. So telling one story to the outside world, even though we know the inside story to be more complicated, as we've done about polygamy, for example. And that when there is retrenchment, this in turn leads within Mormon people to a lot of in-group microviolence, right? We take it out on each other. We excommunicate. We shame people who don't fall in line against the perceived threat of the outside world, which in turn has led throughout Mormon history to the creation of sort of stigmatized dissident Mormon groups. We can see this in 19th century Mormonism, early 20th century Mormonism, early Mormon feminism, you know, people who are pushed out of the faith who then go to the outside world and tell the story of how horrible Mormonism can be on the inside, which then starts the cycle of shaming and caricature and antagonism all over again. I know it's a lot to sort of listen to, but if you see it, you can kind of see this whole cycle driven by shame, where we are made to feel ashamed about ourselves as Mormons, and that we take it out and try and like batten down the hatches and retrench, push people who don't fall in line out, and then the cycle goes all over again. I mean, John, you know, broke that cycle in some ways, or tried to, by standing at times. I think at times he fell into it, as we all do, but at times by just saying, look, you know, what does it mean to explore our flaws publicly? And we see that the church really pulled from that, and, you know, that the cycle of retrenchment is very much in place. And it has even been escalated by the excommunication, and that kind of excommunication, I mean, that kind of escalation we see at work right now on Facebook, you know, shaming of each other, even breaking down within Mormon progressive communities with disagreements and recriminations against each other during it. These are all very normal human dynamics, but they reflect the kind of microviolence of escalation. So, you know, my question is, what can we do to de-escalate and transform this cycle? I love Jennifer's question. Who are we going to be in this moment? You know, what is Mormonism going to be? Will it always be caught in this cycle where we are, you know, driven by militancy and shame and retrenchment and discipline? Will we ever you know, emerge as a more open, as, you know, a more open world faith. And that's the question that's on my heart. And so thinking about ways to de-escalate, you know, that's the historian's view, but then as a sort of a person of faith, thinking about how can I de-escalate? What do I do to de-escalate this cycle, recognizing that change never comes from escalation. Escalation only hardens and, you know, amplifies the most extreme voices. It doesn't change dynamics. You know, and one thing I've been thinking a lot about is how do we become more resilient to shame as Mormon people? I mean, you know, we're all familiar with the place many of us didn't want to go as our faith got more complicated, which is to sort of a militant ex-Mormonism that could say nothing but, oh, Joseph Smith was a fraud and it was all completely terrible. I mean, a lot of us, we won't go there. So what, you know, how can we resist playing into the dynamics of shame the world has heaped upon Mormonism and that we've tried to defend ourselves against? So, you know, being very alert to shame in this moment, not shaming people on your Facebook wall for failing to fall in line with, you know, a position that you think is the right one, I hope can help transform this cycle for us. And so that's a lot of what I've been thinking about in terms of this moment in history and the longer cycles of Mormon history that I think are painful to witness, and I hope there's another way.
Lovely.
I know there's a lot in there.
There's a lot. If we had 4 or 5 hours, we could unpack it all.
Yeah, the graphics will help.
Great. That'll be good to put on there.
Well, and just, Joanna, I saw you in San Diego kind of do that graphic in more detail, and I saw you model even with a person there who was just, you know, in the mode of, you know, there's so much good, so why do you talk about any of the bad, you know, and let the one overwhelm the other one, and you did such a brilliant job. But to me, just to spend a little more time, if you would, on that point of when we either escalate in our own head, you know, tie it to Natasha's comment earlier about, you know, when we're angry, we're kind of stupider, you know, you know, that was a fun way to phrase it.
And there's no question. This is such a difficult moment. And, you know, who are we? What is this we have given our lives to? You know, how did this faith both make us and give us so much goodness and is yet so intolerant to the adults we have become? These are painful questions. And the people who antagonize progressive or, you know, unorthodox Mormons in this moment are scared and defensive. They're watching family and friends walk, and they're doing exactly what they've been taught by the tradition to do their whole life, which is pull in and batten down the hatches and get more orthodox. So, you know, it is difficult on all sides of this story for everyone, because there's such love and commitment, you know, to this faith.
I would say these kinds of tensions, right, between your belonging to the group and being true to your integrity or what you really feel, that pressure drives, it forges development. Okay, and I
exactly.
think there's nothing like, I mean, as hard as it is, okay, there's nothing like these moments to pressure the question of who you're going to be, because you can kind of retreat into a kind of compliance or what I would say indulge a kind of hostility. Neither one is particularly developed or mature.
Right, right.
But it's really pressuring you to kind of define what you think is right or good or kind. And I think, you know, frankly, it's really hard to de-escalate in these moments. This is the really important question, I think, for the discussion is, what do we literally do to stay productive in the face of all of our feelings, in the face of the hostility we see being expressed by others? It's really at the core of I think, a Christian message of how
right.
do you basically really care for and do the right thing in the face of hostility coming your direction
right.
or dissent or anger, you know, so.
Right. And this is, you know, and this is not just, I mean, it's a Christian ethic, but for me, I am really trying to feel in this moment, can we do Mormonism another way? Is it possible? Is it possible? Or are we always going to be caught up in these cycles of retrenchment and group boundary maintenance and, you know, excommunication, exclusion of difference? And I think, you know, where I find myself turning is to the example of an older generation of Mormon progressives who, you know, they went through this stuff. Mm-hmm. They just didn't have podcasts. And they were maybe more gracious than we are. And they were maybe less effective than we are. But, you know, I found myself reading Francis Menlove's book that Dan put out. I think of Jean England. I think of Bob Reese's example. I think of Lester Bush. I think of people who, Lil Bunyan, you know, people who went through this before us. How did they do it? Can we dedicate the sacrifice of our anger of the place we want to go to that tradition of Mormonism and claim that tradition of Mormonism in this moment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because, you know, I personally just think, when I think about what it means to be a Mormon, and I don't mean this in any categorical way, or that I'm excluding others from defining either what it means to be Mormon or what it means to be another faith, can't mean the same thing as what I'm going to say. But being a Mormon for me means standing up for truth, even if it is not orthodox and even if it offends other people, is to stand for what I really believe is true. That's how to be a responsible Mormon. And that is fundamental to contributing to that faith community and to loving the group, even though it will cause friction. Mm-hmm. So it's, for me, it's really around, like, do we have the courage to kind of stand up and co-create what Mormonism is going to be, rather Absolutely. Than just letting it come from the top down?
Absolutely.
Well, and I think that you're hitting on some, like, principles, you know, because I think most Mormons would say, of course, stand for truth.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's like two groups of women on the internet that say stand for something, and they're diametrically opposed to each other, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But, and so this is how we interpret the principles. And, you know, I always kind of go back to the prioritization of principles. So in other words, we have this principle of obedience.
Right.
And so many would say, well, to be a Mormon means to stand and sustain the priesthood, which represents God. You know, I'm going to put my trust in that, and I'm going to follow that. So, you know, some of us might call that blind obedience, but I think that's highly offensive to people who really see that as a trusting way of worship, you know, towards something that they see as divine. But then there's also this, you know, stand for the right and let the consequence follow. Well, again, in Mormonism, that's just assumed that the consequence is going to be outside of the Mormon faith, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to be the world that gives us the consequences, not this within kind of Mormonism that there's going to be consequences for doing what you think is right. And so, you know, again, like what you're saying, Jennifer, so resonates with me and kind of is what I am always about. And yet when people push back on my ideas or my beliefs or the way that I frame things, I can tell that it's not that we're not all standing for truth. It's that my truth and their truth are very different.
Absolutely.
And what they, you know, what I see as painful or harmful and that I want to stand up against, other people may see me as a threat. Right. And so this is where it gets so complicated.
But what I would say, though, is that if that other person is really standing for what they believe, even if it's diametrically opposed to what I'm standing for, we're still doing our job. That's how I see it. I'm not saying if people stand for truth, they're all going to see things my way. It's that the problem is that we don't tolerate that well.
Right.
We want compliance. We want conformity. It's just a human reality. And then we use hostility to kind of, you know, I watched this 60 Minutes show where they took these cute babies and just to give, you know, these were baby bigots. They were adorable, but they were little bigots. And they would like to see a puppet get punished if it didn't like the same, you know, Cheerios versus Fruit Loops, you know, if it didn't choose the same food they liked. And this is just a very human, natural man response to be hostile towards people that are different than us, that don't conform to what we want. I think that's counter to the best in humanity and the best in religion.
But go ahead, sorry.
So all I'm saying is that tension is really productive if we don't try to shut it down with hostility. I think it's very hard, but that's where I push myself on my good days, to try to not just be hateful or hostile towards the people who see things differently than me, and to try and extend understanding, compassion, and goodness in the face of those differences.
See, and what I think it taking the macro view is so hard about this moment is acknowledging those group dynamics as very human and natural.
Mm-hmm.
But also thinking about Mormonism as a movement and its boldness, the boldness of our history. I mean, come on now. I grew up in the 80s and 90s and we were going to take over the world. And
yeah.
we are at a moment where we can't even confront our own history. What mm-hmm. does that mean for the boldness of this movement? That's the heartbreaking moment we're at. It's like we were raised to be so unafraid to go out and make hard choices and sacrifice our lives for them. And the church now finds its way to an excommunication court, not just over a question of authority as it did in the 90s, right? And, of you know, who has the right to criticize in public, but an authority specifically tied to truth claims and sort of the facticity of the Mormon record, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we can't find the resources within the institution, it appears in this moment, to address those with dexterity, with nuance, even just to tolerate a podcaster. Like, we can't find that. Like, we can't do that. And that's the heartbreaking moment of this. It's like, is this the Mormonism? How come we're so brave? I credit all my courage to being raised Mormon, you know, to growing up, standing up for my faith. How come we're so brave and the big institution can't seem to be, and that's the thing, you know, that's the hard thing about this moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I agree with that. And then I think that, again, like most progress, it's not this nice leveled upward ladder,
no.
right? It's more like the stock market, right? And so there's like ups and downs. Because, you know, I think that as I'm looking at this cycle that you are talking about, Joanna, and some of the things you're talking about, Jennifer, with just human nature, those will always probably be with us. You know, I'm not sure that we'll ever completely evolve out of those types of cycles, and especially when we feel threatened. You know, we're kind of talking about the piece of where we feel scared or afraid, and we've got to put our defenses up. And so, but I do still see movement. You know, I do still see movement in the right direction. I mean, we are having conversations that, you know, I don't think 30 years ago would have even been broached, you know. So even though you're right that a podcaster is not tolerated, which seems kind of silly, at the same time, we're having conversations we've never had before as open as we've had them, you know, currently.
Oh,
and there are pockets, right? There are pockets in our Mormonism where this is actually being tolerated quite well.
Yeah.
Granted, it might be on the East Coast or, you know, in California, or it might be in places that are not, you know, as entrenched as right in the middle of Mormon counties. But so, you know, it's that. I guess that dynamic of progress and what progress looks like. And again, for me, as a, you know, thinking about family systems and seeing Mormonism as a family system, in essence, that's kind of how families grow and change. They make mistakes, they hurt each other, but over time they usually do better. And that is hopeful. One of the suggestions I was going to put out there is, you know, just trying to, figure out what we have in common. You know, again, when we get afraid and hurt, we go into our corners and start licking our wounds instead of really understanding, wait a minute, you know, I think that, you know, John Dolan, for example, and President King, or I think that's the name of his stake president, if they really sat down with a mediator, they would probably have like 80% to 90% of their values and ethics and morals in common.
Mm-hmm.
And even many of their Mormon, you know, kind of background and history and whatever you want to call it, Mormon-esqueness. I love making up words. anyway, that I'm just, you know, we forget and we focus, we like hyper-focus in on the differences because that's what stands out. You know, you think about a field of daisies and there's one red poppy in there. Well, what stands out? It's the one red poppy because your eye is drawn to that. And that's oftentimes what happens in family systems, any system, is that we really focus in on the differences because, again, back in the day, those differences could kill you. You know?
Now,
you know, that could have been the leopard, right, and that was coming to pounce on your family. But so now it's not maybe a leopard, but we're still kind of, you know, attuned to that difference instead of focusing on the whole field that we have. You know, in common. And that's what's so tragic, I think, about it. mm-hmm. but hopeful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'll say one more thing and then I'll stop talking so much. But I would say, you know, one of the things I really appreciate in what Joanne is saying is she's giving the larger view, you know, the kind of let's look at why are we so reactive as a faith, or why are we so protective of ourselves and so defensive and so shame driven, meaning understanding the shame focus helps to understand many of the behaviors. And I think, as Natasha was saying, like, compassion, if you can sort of put yourself in another's shoes, you have a better ability to understand how they've come up with the ideologies and the frameworks in their life that have helped to make sense of it, and why another person's idea can feel threatening to that framing that has grounded their life. And, you know, if you can just allow yourself to understand, I understand you and I understand why you probably think like you do and I think like I do, and we can still be friends and not necessarily judge each other. I mean, that's really where our hope is, I think.
Can you be more merciful if you can see someone who's really taking an adversarial point of view in a dialogue as part of the same history? History
right.
put them in their shoes. History put you in your shoes. You're playing these roles history has assigned to you. And depersonalize it. Can you de-escalate if you can depersonalize a little bit?
Yeah, good point. I like that.
How would you answer your questions, Joanna?
Putting her feet to the fire.
I'm legitimately curious. I respect this woman.
Like, about which questions? Like, how did?
Well, one specifically about how to, you know, where do we go from here? How do we make room for something that looks different than what you're kind of cyclically seeing?
Yeah. No. I mean, I think one of the things I've been trying to do in the past few months, I've been a little less vocal in predictable ways, has been to figure that out. You know, I think we've had a wonderful run with progressive Mormonism. It's not over. Oh, no. Every generation is going to bring these same questions. They are not going anywhere. But, you know, look at the past, 10 years from the rise of blogging as this, you know, fascinating startup and, moving through the cycle of growth. And, I'm not sure what's next, you know, for many of us, I think, are in this moment sort of unsure what's next for our institutional affiliation. I mean, I'm not going anywhere. I'm a Mormon, you know, but I was talking to my daughter in the car today, tonight, and I picked her up from school, you know, and she knows John, and you know, they excommunicated John today. And she's like, for what? And I said, well, you know, this podcast and this, you know, raising questions. She says, you mean they excommunicated him for having an opinion? You know, I'm like, oh, it's true. My kids are becoming Jewish. What can I say? They're in a bi-faith household, bi-religious household. But I think this is a moment of great uncertainty, and I wish I had answers. And, you know, I've been trying to be very reflective and very thoughtful, and I haven't had answers, so I haven't been saying much. But, you know, I think Dan had poked me about a poem I wrote. I woke up, I cried a lot about Kate. I cried a lot. And with John, because I haven't cried quite as much, and I haven't been quite as scared. And I thought I was sort of very calm about the whole thing, but I had this dream Friday night and woke up Saturday morning. And in this dream, there are these really clear words. I'll tell you about the dream in a minute in the poem, but, you know, and I was like, wow, well, that's a really significant dream. That happens sometimes. Wow, what a blessing. And then I realized a few hours later, I'm like, oh, I'm supposed to write this down. This is about the excommunication. I'm supposed to write this down. I'm supposed to give this to people. So I put this on Ask Mormon Girl on Saturday after, you know, writing and crying for a few hours, which is how it works. And this is the best answer I have right now. A poem from my brothers and sisters. Last night, I dreamed I stood at the edge of the parade route. My friend Claire at my side, a shade over our heads, a ridge of red sandstone mountains against the far horizon. Then they came in the noonday sun, our people so fierce, so tender, so terrible, the men carrying books translated out of air, out of hats, out of hunger, eyes straight ahead, unafraid of looking foolish to the world if it meant they could beat down death. The women, too, pioneer skirts across the backs of horses, long guns at their sides, priestesses they were, tall, soft-spoken, square-shouldered, priestesses of a kind this world has never seen. I tried to tell Claire how proud I was to see them. From the time I was a kid, the way my heart would throw itself against my bones saying, true, true, true. Or was it feeling, feeling, feeling? I watched it all pass in front of me, and just before I woke, the words came. It is worthy of being loved. It is worthy of being grieved. The only reason I write is because the words come. The only reason they come is for you. The words came in my dream last night to tell you that all we have given to it, our dead relatives and our living, our black mornings bent over scriptures mapping a world that never existed, the homely white clothing we stepped into to make promises with words, with hands, with bodies, how hard we worked to keep those promises, how we punished ourselves when we could not, the hours, the hours, the hours, how do you begin to count them? All of it, the grandeur and the failure, yours and mine and that of our people, it is worthy of being loved. It is worthy of being grieved. You are worthy of being loved. You are worthy of being grieved. You are worthy. So that's my answer. Is that like everything we've been through, it's worthy. It's been worth it. It's been worth the sacrifice that we are showing up for each other in this moment, that we don't have anything to be ashamed of, even in these difficult moments. We don't have to be ashamed of the earlier, more literal believing selves we were. Well, I'm not even going to be ashamed of a church that's in the throes of maturation. Just that we have this tremendous experience, difficult experience of being Mormon people is where I'm standing right now.
Yeah, I love that, Joanna, and I've always loved your voice.
Yes, lovely and wise.
Thank you so much, Joanna. Dan, I'm gonna turn it to you. And as we've been talking here about how to do this, I just keep thinking of that section in Job 2 where his friends, they saw how awful he was looking, and they tore their clothes and they just sat with him for however many days or however long they sat with him. And to me right now, that makes the most sense. Instead of telling people to calm down or giving advice or escalating things myself, maybe it's best to just be there. And that's what I got from Joanna's poem, was just to be in there and keep living it. But Dan, why don't you share your thoughts on the situation and any wisdom you might have tucked away in there.
Well, that was a good one from you just then. That was when Job's friends, you know, that's in the framing section of Job, and before they really screwed up and started to try to give him answers for his suffering.
Yeah.
You know, so that was very powerful. Job and the writer of Job really put some things in tension there in a great way. Well, I feel really good about what I kind of brought with me to speak tonight, because it touches on things that are all over the discussion so far. But now I got to stand and deliver, so it makes me nervous to try to do this. Basically, you know, I was really blessed to be asked a few months ago to speak at Sunstone Northwest up in Seattle in the middle of November. Lindsay Hansen Park asked me to lead off the conference, and the conference was called Inclusion and Influence in the Borderlands. And she just said, you know, Dan, do something if you can just to make sure that everybody feels welcome, you know, here. And she put it under the term Borderlands, which I think we all like, from Jeff Burton, kind of made that nice map of those who are on the edges and yet, you know, still part of the group and things like that. And as I reflected for that symposium, a couple more images or metaphors came to mind. First, the first one was easy, and that was obviously Christ from 1 Corinthians and the body of Christ. Paul from 1 Corinthians, the body of Christ, and how we need everybody. And I did some reflection on that. But the more important one, and it's kind of a little joke, I kind of said, hey, can I propose something that we might want to call ourselves other than Borderlanders? And I threw out the term Gappers, G-A-P-P-E-R-S. And I said, this won't make any sense to you now, but I think it will by the end of it. And so that's kind of, I want to just kind of throw out something for you that is a framing for the long haul. And it's a framing that I think can ultimately help us stay healthy, you know, even for the long battle. You know, I'm always never saying that I'm finished or I've reached clarity or anything like that. I'm always from the middle of the battlefield. But right now I'm 25 years, you know, into this, you know, maybe 12 years past the major crisis points in my life. And there's things that have helped me along the way kind of renew my spirit, even when, you know, change isn't coming, when things aren't going my way, you know, when things are out of my control, I can only control, you know, certain things within me. So lots of what you were saying, Jennifer, about how do I think about it? So how do I decide today? And so I just wanted to kind of share some things there. So this idea of tragic or gapper comes from a phrase that I and sort of a thought that if anybody is familiar with Parker Palmer, he's an amazing Quaker thinker, teacher, educator, community activist. He's just a fantastic, wise person and a mentor of mine through his books and chances when I have to see videos and him interact. And anyway, he came up with this phrase called the tragic gap. And it is I guess I picked up on it 7 or 8 years ago, but it's been more and more in front of me lately. And he basically says that there's this gap between what is and what could be and what should be. It's the gap between the reality of a given situation and an alternative reality we know to be possible because we've experienced it. You know, we've seen it with our own eyes. We know, for instance, that greed is everywhere, but we've also seen generosity. We know that, you know, the communities want us to, or we know that people want us to idealize individuals, but we can see what's happened when you're in wonderful communities. So you see realities, and yet you know that at times we've acted better. And so there's this tragic gap that we're trying to keep in tension. Again, going back to some of the things that you said, Jennifer, just this healthy way to keep in tension things. And so he says we have a choice. We can hold the tension between reality and possibility in life-giving ways. And we can witness with our life, another way of living, slowly and patiently calling ourselves in our part of the world towards something better. You can maybe tell that I'm reading some of from my notes here. I'm trying to do a combo of talking and reading from my talk there. But, you know, it's a difficult tension to hold. And if we can't, then we collapse. You know, when two horns of a dilemma or two things in tension, you know, get too tragic for or too hard for us, we'll collapse one and we'll go. And so he says there's cynicism on one end, you know, well, greed and everything is out there, so I'm going to go get mine. You know, you can say I'll forget the ideal and I'll just do that. Or you can go, he says, into, you know, irrelevant idealism. Oh, wouldn't it be lovely if, you know, and you just kind of start ignoring the actual realities that are on the ground that don't fit from you. So, you know, I love John Lennon's Imagine, but, you know, I don't think it's the healthiest model. Imagine there's no heaven. You know, imagine there's no religion. Imagine there's no country. All those kinds of things. Those are wonderful for a while, but you can't have a healthy life or a healthy, you know, even pathway to peace if it's just an absence of tension. So this tragic gap is what he's done, and we probably ought to serve ourselves a little bit by thinking of the word tragic, and, you know, because right now it's always like, oh, that's a tragedy, and then we think of disasters and hurricanes and earthquakes and, you know, airplanes crashing, and we forget that the roots of tragedy are more like in that ancient Greek sense, and you see it in Shakespearean tragedies where there's something inevitable about life. There's something inexorable, something inescapable, that there's facts of existence and inevitable flaws in the human condition, and we just need to do that. So when we see it, we go to a Shakespearean tragedy, or we kind of, you know, enter into that mode of tragic space, we see things happening that we don't really want, and we don't want it for that character. And we'll see them trudging along and moving, you know, in these predictable ways, and we can kind of see outcomes and whatnot. But we're strangely empowered and ennobled to see somebody striving you know, against their own character flaws or against the forces of history. And so even though you wouldn't say that, oh, I'm going to a Shakespearean tragedy for lots of laughs, you know, they can be very uplifting. And so Parker Palmer, you know, by throwing this tragic gap here, also sent me right to, if anybody hasn't read this, this is one of the greatest pieces in all of Mormon, you know, writing of this, you know, last 30, 40 years. It's Carlisle Hunsaker, and he wrote a piece called Mormonism and the Tragic Sense of Life. And it was interesting, just three or four issues ago, Stephen Carter republished it in Sunstone. So it was probably done in the 80s or whatever. And he basically also talked about how Mormonism, and you'll hear echoes of, you know, Eugene England's idea about the weeping God of Mormonism, how God himself, God themselves, find themselves in a tragic world, a world in which, like, you know, that cry from Moses 7, I would that they would do this, but they don't. They hate their own flesh and blood. You know, they I want them to choose me, to choose life, to choose, you know, richness, and they choose smallness instead. And so, you know, that's in his exchange with Enoch, as Enoch says, how is it, God, that you can weep, you know, when Satan is over there laughing and things like that. And so this whole idea that Mormonism has a real sense of, you know, a God who's in a predicament like us, where the most that God can do is persuade and call us to our highest selves, and hopefully within our own spiritual lives and things like that, we've gained some resources to say, I'm willing to be a co-creator and to fight against the tragic nature of this world and to struggle, you know, struggle valiantly, even though, and you know, we got Reinhold Niebuhr, one of his most famous quotes of all times is, nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in a lifetime. You know, it's, you know, and there was a great phrase from Parker Palmer. I'm scrolling back for my notes here, but it has to do with the idea that, you know, Martin Luther King, you know, never got to live to see the full victory. Mother Teresa doesn't get to live to see it. Gandhi doesn't live to see it. None of us will ever see the full victory, but how can we, you know, keep going? So Carlisle Hunsaker, the one other piece that I would do is he gives lots of good framings for it, but one of the things that he says that Mormonism can really help, you know, nuance and make this tragic gap even more profound for us, is this extra thing that says, for him, developing the tragic set of life includes our willingness to view our pervasive shortcomings against the backdrop of our divine potential. So again, when we, you know, we're putting these stakes out here, and we in Mormonism add this level of divine potential in us, and so this gap is within ourselves as well as, you know, the world that we're acting in. So I just wanted to do one more quick thing, and this is, I also tied in there, and this is my other, you know, besides trying to get the meme going of calling ourselves gappers, I have another phrase that has just been super powerful for me, and it comes from Krista Tippett's book called Speaking of Faith. It's on page 185 where it starts. She talks about the spiritual geniuses of the ages and of the everyday don't let despair have the last word. And then here's my favorite part. Nor do they close their eyes to its pictures or deny the enormity of its facts. They say yes, and they wake up the next day and the day after that to act and live accordingly. So they say yes. They don't close their eyes to all the pain. They don't close their eyes to all the suffering. But then they add that word and. And so her phrase, yes, and, I'm kind of hoping would become a meme. She's never done anything with it. But maybe just as a kind of a self-talk moment to say, yep, I see that, I feel this, and what am I going to do today? And ultimately, that's where the renewal is. The final Parker Palmer piece is something that I actually posted this past Sunday in a Thoughtful Faith group. It has to do with we have to find some other measure than the world coming our way in order for us to feel renewal of energy. He says we have to change our calculus from one that worries about effectiveness, and we have to change it to one that worries about faithfulness. And when he defines faithfulness, it has nothing to do with God and Jesus and things like this, but it's faithfulness to our gifts, faithfulness to who we are and the call of our hearts. This is where, you know, you talked about, Jennifer, again, standing for my truth. If we're faithful to ourselves, you know, we can sustain ourselves. We'll find renewal in things like that. If we're always worried, like we're getting the attaboys or the strokes, or, you know, the church came our way, there was a good press conference instead of a bad one, you know, or maybe those leaders overnight would have truly prayed and John wouldn't have been excommunicated. If we're waiting for that, we're doomed to fail. But if we're in that mode of faithfulness to our gifts, to what we know to be true and things like that, right there, we can just renew ourselves. We can simply say, well, I can't control the outcome, but I can control what I do. Again, hearkening back to you guys, this is what I can do. So that, to me, is a long-term framing. You know, I always hesitate to say it, but this is really how my life has worked. Early on in my faith crisis, I said, who do I admire the most? Who do I think pulled it together? And I'm with Joanna and naming some of those same names. I mean, my immediate and proximal one was Randy Paul, but immediately right after that was Gene England and Lowell Bennion and people like this that I simply said, you know, somehow or other, they found secret. They found a peace. They found confidence in themselves that they're plugged into an energy source and it's them and God, but yet still willing to be in this world of the gap in Mormonism between, you know, the ideal and the real, and doing it every day. And so, you know, I'm nowhere close to them, but having that model of, you know, people that kind of aren't going to flash and burn out in my mind has helped me. So that's what I'll offer for today's framings.
That's wonderful.
That's great, Dan. You know, it just kind of, as you're talking about the gap and the tragedy, that's the kind of stuff that we're drawn to, as you were saying. I mean, Old Man and the Sea is a kind of a horrible story, but we're drawn to that. And we, you know, as I'm reading it, I'm thinking about those stupid sharks eating this great fish that he caught and ruining this great effort. And I think that we're drawn to it because that's what life is like. Life isn't this ideal. And as I've kind of come onto this online Mormon scene quite late, and, you know, I have my faith crisis. And then for me, for a while, everything looked really, really good. I mean, all these podcasts are going on and no one's having any trouble. The essays start coming out. The church is going to change, you know, and I kind of had this ideal, maybe a naive dream that, wow, we're really turning a corner. But it's a longer... And it's a longer process that requires more work, requires more patience, and something that we'll have to live through. Is there anything else that any of you would like to respond to, or any thoughts that have come up as others have been talking?
All I would say is, and I've probably said it already, but I think what Dan is describing in that for me is like, that is what it means to be a spiritual being, is to be able, meaning spiritual development is measured in my mind by how much of the reality of life, all the suffering, the cruelty, the sort of the despairing part that you can metabolize, honestly metabolize, and still move forward and still have faith to reach for the best in humanity. And it takes real strength. And it's literally what we develop through our choices of who we're going to be in moments of despair or pain or anguish or powerlessness or less power than we want to have, and to still be an agent, to still act. And I think so many of those ideas are so very much a part of our faith. And I think personally, I was just interviewed on this with in Dialogue magazine about integrity, but I think, you know, that sometimes it really gets lost in all the framing of obedience and compliance and authority. But really what the gospel is about in my mind is, and spirituality is about, is really around who we are in these moments.
Gorgeous.
I would second that, and then also add to that, as far as just from a descriptive sense, that how we respond to that may look so dramatically different. You know, like
I'm already seeing people saying things like, you know, this really is kind of the last straw for me. And, you know, I think this is going to be it for me and the church, you know, this decision.
Right.
We saw kind of some of the same response when Kate Kelly was excommunicated. There are other people that are like, you know what, this just makes me want to hang in there even more. And, you know, I'm seeing positive changes and I want to be part of them. So there's not like a wrong or right. It's more about the process, I think, of what Jennifer's speaking to that is happening in the individual journey of spirituality. And I think one of the things that I love about Mormonism is that invitation to have a personal relationship with divinity and, you know, the concepts around agency and the concepts around, you know, that idea that you can't really live on borrowed light. And so it's not the sense that we don't want to share or anything, but everybody has to kind of come up with their own way that's going to be spiritually healthy and uplifting and edifying for them. So that may be outside of our Mormon faith. It may be within. It may be a weird combination of all those things. But I think that's where what I would like to see, kind of going back to Joanna's points, are can we up the tolerance for that? Can we really preach what we can we really live what we preach? And I think the Mormon message is, here's the invitation. You know, here's Moroni. Read it. You know, hear it, pray it, live it, but you're going to have to figure it out for you. And then, oh, but you don't get the answer I do. Oh, well, now I'm going to shame you is not an appropriate response. That's not part of the gospel. Right? So I think it's that idea of how do we tolerate our individual spiritual journeys as we live amongst each other and as we try to commune with one another. And there'll be times when you're sitting next to somebody at church where you'll have very similar spiritual journeys. And there'll be times when you have very different ones. And how do we still, you know, commune as a family? And I think that's the invitation that is so powerful and that we're all kind of speaking to. And I've seen progress in that regard, and I've seen heartache in that regard. And it just kind of is, it's very individual.
Right.
Joanna, do you have any closing thoughts there?
I said everything I know how to say.
Nice.
But just again, like today I've been in a place of feeling, you know, as we've reached out to other people and been reached out to, comforting each other and listening to each other, that this is a religious community. This is. Even progressive Mormons who feel very strange, we honor our lifetime of devotion to this movement that is Mormonism in the way we care for one another and show up for one another and care so intensely. So I'm still feeling the strength of this faith as we process this loss.
Neat. If I could just add one last thing, it's, I recognize that the stuff that I was kind of talking about does not help in the immediate moment very much. And I don't think it helps maybe younger people as much as it helps a lot of us who've maybe gone through that midlife sort of phase of reevaluating what is life all about, what are the big themes. But maybe by saying it now at whatever age and hearing it, it might make more sense, because it just doesn't sound attractive that I'm going to live in a tragic world and I'm going to really own that. And I would rather escape, you know, the pulls in both directions, the tensions, and collapse one or the other. But, you know, so I recognize that it isn't for now. And I'll just let you know, for those who heard me in Sunstone West in San Diego, I talked about this moment. It was San Diego. Sunstone West came right between when John's court, you know, his disciplinary council was postponed for a couple of weeks, and it came right after the church's press conference. And I just had to share that this was a time when I was feeling extremely down, you know, how I'm kind of known for being, you know, Mr. Energy and Mr. Optimism and stuff on the thing. And I shared just how Jackson Brown, as I was heading back to San Diego and my deep love for the ocean, how Jackson Brown's song, Rock Me on the Water, you know, Sisters of the Sun, you gotta ease, you know, soothe my fevered brow. And I did a lot of my remarks in that theme of, of, you know, man, take the time and go inward and recover and gain your strength. I taught Sunday school recently, and it was the Jesus temptation stuff. You know, you cannot handle the worst impulses. You cannot handle things unless you're spiritually strong. And so, like you were saying, Joanne or Natasha just now, we've got to go get our own relationship with God. We've got to plug in to where we truly do know where our gifts are. We truly are independent spiritually from, you know, what others do around us. Obviously, we're affected by it, but ultimately, you know, that's the pipeline where we can gain that strength.
Thanks, Dan, and thanks to all of you for coming on and really providing great perspective, great ways to think this through and, you know, allow ourselves, give ourselves space to process and move forward however we need to move forward. So thank you, all of you, for coming on. This has been a great discussion.
Thank you,
Brian.
Thanks for having us.
Much love to you. Much love to everybody.